Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Judge Bauer and I would like to welcome Judge Phil Simon from the Northern District of Indiana, who is sitting with us today by designation. And with that introduction made, I will call the first case this morning. It is Rubin versus the Islamic Republic of Iran, case number 082805.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sharon Swingle from the Department of Justice representing the United States. I'm here this morning as amicus curiae in support of reversal, and I want to thank the Court for the opportunity to be here. Obviously, the questions of foreign sovereign immunity at issue in this case are ones of significant interest to the United States. They have an impact not just in this case, obviously, but in all litigation involving foreign states in U.S. courts, and also have a ramification for the treatment of the U.S. in foreign courts abroad under principles of reciprocity. I begin by addressing the district court's ruling that foreign sovereign immunity from execution is an affirmative defense that can be raised only by the foreign state itself. I think this is an erroneous decision for a number of reasons. First, it ignores the plain language of 1609, which establishes a presumption of immunity for foreign state property and requires that property be shown to fall within the specific exceptions to immunity in 1610A before execution or other coercive measures are appropriate. Second, I think it really misconstrues the waiver provision of 1610A1. In establishing the presumption of immunity, Congress dictated what would constitute an appropriate waiver of the immunity of foreign state property, and simply failing to appear, as this Court recognized in similar circumstances in Frolova, is not a basis for finding waiver. Rather, the foreign state must affirmatively, either explicitly or implicitly, waive its immunity. So I think that, too, is really flatly inconsistent with the notion that by failing to appear in an action and argue for immunity, the foreign state has waived immunity.
Your argument on this point is not a jurisdictional argument, but rather an argument about how the statute was meant to operate?
That's correct, Your Honor. We do not view this as being an issue that goes to the subject matter jurisdiction of the Court. I think by registering the judgment here under 28 U.S.C. 1963, the District Court did have jurisdiction. I think, however, as this Court recognized in Autotech, the constraints in 1609, 1610, and 1611 really go to the authority of the Court in this area, and I think both the Court's affirmative defense ruling and its subsequent discovery order sort of blew by those limitations on the Court's authority in a way that could have really significant ramifications for the United States government in its dealings with foreign states and abroad. So although it is not a question of jurisdiction, we do think it's a critical question in terms of the Court's authority. As the D.C. Circuit recognized in Papandrea, for example, where although the Court recognized that limited discovery might be appropriate in establishing jurisdiction over a foreign state, it held that where that discovery had gone so far outside the bounds of propriety, it would exercise its mandamus jurisdiction to entertain the action. Returning to the question of immunity, I think 1609, 1610, and 11 also have to be viewed against the history of immunity of foreign state property. Traditionally, of course, foreign state property was absolutely immune from any coercive measures. Only with enactment of the FSIA was that changed, but it was changed only in part, and it was changed with the understanding that execution would be appropriate, typically where a foreign state had come into the commercial marketplace and operated like a private person in the marketplace. So I think even the seminal case recognizing foreign sovereign immunity before enactment of the FSIA, the Schooner Exchange, recognized that foreign state immunity was appropriately considered by the Court, regardless whether the foreign state had itself come into court to make that argument. In the Schooner Exchange itself, the property was alleged to belong to the Emperor of France. It was a military ship. France never appeared. The claim of immunity was only made by a representative of the United States government, and it was, of course, recognized by the Supreme Court in an opinion by Chief Justice Marshall. So I think in all of these issues point to the same conclusion, which is a district court has an obligation under the FSIA to consider whether foreign state property is immune from execution. It must do so regardless whether the foreign state has appeared. It must consider the claims of a third party that property might be immune from execution. And I would note in this regard that the United States government frequently is involved in litigation in foreign courts in which a default judgment is entered against it. Perhaps the United States views itself as not having been properly served and declines to appear, but we frequently rely on third parties, banks, other possessors of U.S. governmental assets, to make execution immunity arguments on our behalf.
So why wasn't this case appealed back in 2006?
Well, Your Honor, you know, without second-guessing the litigation strategy of the actual party, and at that time the...
Could the United States have effectuated an appeal at the time?
We were not a party at that time, Your Honor, and, you know, whether we could have intervened, whether we would have had standing to intervene to seek an immediate appeal, I think is not an issue before the court, and frankly, it's not one that we have determined an answer on. We have at times come into cases in a similar posture, but, for example, they were cases in which it appeared clear that an execution order would put the United States in violation of international agreements, and we certainly wouldn't concede here that that's the case.
Did the United States appear in the Richmark case in the Ninth Circuit?
We did not, Your Honor.
What are we to make of that case? That was sort of a global discovery order akin to the one that we have here.
Well, Your Honor, I think Richmark, and frankly all of the cases that the other side is relying on here, involve circumstances both where there are discovery orders that were not challenged on the merits. In Richmark, for example, the only claim of foreign sovereign immunity that was raised was against the requirement that the foreign state instrumentality post a supersedious bond or actually pay the judgment in order to appeal. The foreign state instrumentality did not challenge the scope of that discovery order. I will say, in the United States government's view, it was simply an abuse of discretion, that order. Among other things, there is no claim that a foreign state instrumentality's extraterritorial assets would be subject to discovery. But of course, because it was a foreign state instrumentality, I do think it is correct that there may well be a broader scope for appropriate discovery there, given the more expansive execution provisions of 1610B. And if I could turn to that discovery order, I think whatever may be the rule in other circuits, and I don't think, frankly, that other circuits have squarely addressed this point, there has never been a court of appeals that has upheld against an immunity challenge a discovery order of the type that was at issue here. I think this court has already recognized in Autotech that a court's kind of inherent authority to manage litigation against a foreign state is circumscribed by the limitations in 1609 and 1610, and that coercive measures against the foreign state have to be viewed in light of those limitations. And I think that has to be the case for discovery as well as other means of coercing compliance with a judgment against a foreign state. Finally, if I could just briefly touch on the appellate jurisdictional question. I think I've already noted that in the government's view, if the court is concerned about its appellate jurisdiction here, and I think the parties have set out in their briefs the basis for jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine, I think in the government's view, certainly the court could treat the appeal as a petition for mandamus. Courts routinely view appeals in the alternative as a petition for mandamus if they have concerns about exercising a traditional appellate authority. And frankly, I think both Papandrea and earlier cases such as Ex parte Peru provide the precedential basis for this court to exercise its supervisory jurisdiction here.
That standard of review is pretty steep if it's a mandamus.
Well, Your Honor, I think as the D.C. Circuit recognized in Papandrea, it is in many ways similar to the collateral order doctrine. I think here you have a case in which the district court has purported to exercise an execution authority that really takes no regard either of the statutory limitations on its authority nor the statutory limitations on the scope of assets that would be subject to executional measures. And I think in light of the really significant ramifications of that type of order on our foreign relations and the impropriety, frankly, of requiring a foreign state to go into contempt as a means of obtaining immediate appellate review, it would be an appropriate case for mandamus. The questions we would ask for reversal.
Thank you. Mr. Kilcoyne.
If it please the court, I'm Thomas Corcoran, counsel for Iran. And if it please the court, I will address the general assets order and leave the appearance order to Mr. Ferranti. I'll start, because we haven't got much time, with Autotech. Iran, this case deals with Iran, but the principles that you will establish today will apply to all foreign states and then by reciprocity to the United States. As this court decision in Autotech established, when it comes to attachment of assets, different rules apply to sovereigns than to private parties. The plaintiff must first identify specific property which it seeks to attach. The issue in this case is whether an attempt to discover unidentified property, which may or may not be attachable, complies with the procedures required by the FSIA. In our view, the procedures that to be followed in a 1609 proceeding are the same as those in a 1604 proceeding. This is so because, first of all, the language of the two sections, 1604 and 1609, are almost identical. Secondly, Congress in its legislative history twice says the proceedings under 1609 are to be to go forward similarly to 1604. And this case in Autotech has applied 1604 principles in 1609 cases, as have three circuit courts otherwise. That is the Ninth Circuit in ABCAP, the Fifth Circuit in Connecticut Bank, and the Second Circuit in EM Limited.
Counsel, let me just ask you, because I don't really understand why the discovery should be broader when it's against an instrumentality versus against the state itself.
It's because when we're talking about an instrumentality, let's say timber falling in the Richmark case, timber falling was simply a business. And the court just treats it like any other business.
But it's a state-owned business.
Yeah, but...
And so why would there be a distinction between a state-owned business and the state itself? That's what I'm not following.
Because a state is involved in government, and the state-owned business is involved in commerce. So we treat instrumentalities often just like their businesses, which is what they are. And that's a traditional distinction. It's followed in FSIA law. Assuming that the 1604 standards apply, what happens when you make a claim is you have to allege specific facts that show that you're entitled to an exception to immunity under the FSIA. And then get discovery only to verify allegations of specific facts crucial to the claim in that case. I don't know of any FSIA case, any 1604 liability FSIA case, where the plaintiff, after having established that he has he's allowed to go forward with his claim as to one set of facts, then gets to do discovery to see whether he's got another claim. And that's what we have by analogy in this case. 1609, like 1607, like 1604, which is because they're almost identical, protects the foreign state from the burdens of attachment litigation. And just as under 1604 you don't get discovery as to a new claim, here you don't get discovery as to new property. You have to allege the specific property as this court ruled in Autotech.
Does it make any difference, counsel, that 1609 does not appear to be a jurisdictional provision in the sense that 1604 is?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I'm not sure why it would. I mean, I understand why you asked me that, but...
I mean, some of the case law speaks of this in terms of the absence of subject matter jurisdiction. Clearly, that's the case with respect to 1604 because it's jurisdictional immunity.
That's the rationale in one of the cases, but we don't rely on that.
Okay, so you're not making that argument.
No,
to the extent that, that's the basis for some other court's holdings, you're not relying on that.
Okay. That's the FG case, the FG Hemisphere case. Any other position, Your Honor, doesn't make sense. How this court rules today applies not just to Iran, but to all foreign states and the United States by reciprocity.
What is your response to their catch-22 argument? They're saying that they can't attach or execute on this judgment without getting some discovery, but you're requiring them to come up with a specific asset in the first instance. I mean, they're stuck in this circular problem, and what's the pushback to that?
Pushback to that is that's what the Act requires. And let me give you another reason why it should require it. Suppose a U.S. court ordered, say, France to provide all documents relating to any conceivable asset of France in the United States. Suppose a French court ordered the United States to provide all documents relating to a list of all of its assets in France. Neither France nor the United States would comply. Finally, Your Honor, discovery into all assets also violates the Algiers Accords because the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal has ruled that any lien as to any assets which are the subject of the proceedings in the tribunal is a violation of the accords. And the effect of a discovery order in this case would be to place a lien on such assets. I'd like to reserve my remainder time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ferranti.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Bill Ferranti for the Museum Interveners. I'd like to address two points this morning, if I can. First, reversing the 2006 order is necessary to get this case back on track. Despite Iran's appearance, several collections in the museum's possession that are sought by plaintiffs here remain unprotected by the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And second, this makes no sense because sovereign property is immune from attachment. And in attachment proceedings brought by judgment creditors of Iran, asserting that items that the museums hold are sovereign, the museums are entitled to say just that, sovereign property is immune from attachment. And this is because 1609 codifies a presumptive immunity that runs with the property. Now that means that plaintiffs themselves inherently, necessarily, unavoidably invoke 1609 by their own theory. They're the ones who insist the property is sovereign. It becomes part of their burden to establish an exception to the immunity that's codified in 1609.
Let me ask you what I'd ask the lawyer for the government. Why wasn't this appealed in 2006? What it has led to is forced Iran into the case and exposed them to this general asset discovery. And it could have been avoided if we agree with you on your central point.
Right. And I think the first point I'd say, Your Honor, is I'm not sure that the museums themselves could have appealed in 2006. There was no final determination that the properties were not immune from attachment.
Final order.
As to the museums, the immunity that they were asserting was with respect to the property, so it hadn't been finally denied. As to Iran, the immunity is more like an immunity from the burdens of litigation that we see in 11th Amendment cases. So they can assert on a collateral basis before any final decision has been made with respect to the property that their immunity has been denied just by having to show up in court. But that issue aside, Your Honor, whether or not it was appealable in 2006, Iran came into the case. They made the decision that they were willing to suffer the indignity of appearing and filing a motion, which they did. And it's since then, proceedings have just not gotten back on track based on that appearance.
What would have prevented Iran from appearing and immediately appealing?
Nothing, Your Honor. That was a decision that Iran made at the time.
Well, is the earlier order now moot, or any argument pursuant to it moot because of Iran's presence?
Not at all, Your Honor. Now, with respect to the museums, the order is not moot because for several other collections that Iran does not claim, the district court's order has continuing effect. We're not allowed to speak the word immunity. Our briefs have been struck when we mention immunity. And the district court is not allowing Iran to assert immunity with respect to For example, the Hertzfeld collection, which is everything that the plaintiffs are seeking to take from the Field Museum.
Well, in that sense, it is a final order. The earlier order was a final order appealable under the collateral order doctrine because it decided that question against you in a definite way, and that seems to satisfy the rule.
That we would have...
So it was a strategic mistake to seek a 1292B certification of an interlocutory appeal rather than just taking an immediate appeal?
Immediately in the wake of the order, I think it would have seemed moot by Iran's appearance. At that point, the understanding of everybody in the case was that Iran's appearance was going to enable the district court to consider these issues. That turned out not to be the case. Also, even if we passed up an opportunity that we might have had the museums and that Iran certainly did have in 2006 to appeal, there's not just a one and only chance to take an appeal from an order.
Well, we've got a bit of a conflict in our case law in that question between Otis and Weir, where Otis seems to lay down a categorical rule that you got to wait till the final judgment.
Right.
If you pass up the opportunity to take a collateral order on appeal immediately, and then the Weir case says you can do so at the next opportunity, usually the final judgment.
Right.
Straighten that out.
In Otis, however, Your Honor, it was just dicta. What Otis was doing when it made that statement was accepting the argument of the appellee that, yes, it is true that Rule 4, Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4, does apply to collateral orders. The court was saying that's true, and that does have repercussions in some cases. You can lose your opportunity to appeal at the moment, but that's not actually the holding of Otis. The holding of Otis has to do with when you have when an order that sort of has springing finality, when the district court enters an order that will become final upon the happening of a given condition. That's the holding in Otis. And it cites Weir, which, as Your Honor notes, has the broader point. And the language in Weir is also almost word for word found in Moore's Federal Practice. Wright and Miller agrees. I think it's very difficult to make sense of this language without recognizing that there are interim opportunities. And I think that's also the only way to really explain what happened in Michelle's Lounge, with the way the court dealt with the two orders before it in that case, where it found timeliness based on a notice of appeal filed within 30 days of a more recent order, yet then continued to consider the collateral order criteria for the earlier order and found reviewability for that earlier order based on a separate Cohen analysis. We submit the same analysis works here. And in addition, this court also has pendent appellate jurisdiction. The efficiencies involved in reaching the 2006 order, as Your Honor pointed out, this case has turned into a mess because the 2006 order has stayed.
If we agree with you on the 2006 order, do we even have to get to the general asset issue?
I don't think you do, Your Honor.
So practically, what's going to happen here? Let's say we agreed with you, it goes back to the district court, then what's going to happen?
What's going to happen is the museums will be able to assert the immunity of the property, both the property that Iran claims and the property that Iran doesn't. That is everything that the plaintiffs seek here. And Iran will be free at that point to decide to stand on its immunity and walk away from the case or not. That's a choice Iran will be able to make. But from the museum's perspective, we'll at that time finally be free to just finish this case. And that's the problem here, and I guess I can end with this, Your Honor, is that what plaintiffs have told, or what the district court has told plaintiffs, is that they can skip the FSIA analysis. And because of that ruling, what plaintiffs are doing is they're litigating ownership issues without any regard for whether they can ultimately establish commercial use or block assets at the end of the day. They're litigating these issues and forcing the museums to litigate these issues. Sooner or later, they're going to have to face the fact that sovereign property is immune, and if they do it sooner, we can get this case finished. Thank you.
Mr. Strachman.
Good morning. Just before you leap off into a flurry of discussions, I found no place in the record that anybody raised the relief available under Section 1610.2A. Did anybody ask for assistance under that section? Assuming your position is correct, there's no immunity. The statute, I think, is clear. It says that if you request, the Secretary of Treasury and the Secretary of State should make every effort to fully and properly locate the property you're looking for. Is there any reason why it wasn't raised, or am I on the wrong track? And if so, why?
The issue was not raised.
Why not?
I think one basis is that the terrorism victims in general, Your Honor, are weary of seeking guidance from, unfortunately, from the United States. The United States has not in any way been helpful to terrorism victims, not just in this case.
Nobody asked them to be helpful. This section says they have to be helpful if you ask.
Well, I think we'd like to consider that, and I think that's it might be an interesting.
Well, why didn't you?
This case,
the fact that you don't like the government is not particularly material to anything I can think of.
It's not that we don't like it. The problem is, as we can see today from simply the order of argument, the government has never helped.
Your position, but the statute is fairly clear that they have to cooperate with you. You've got a judgment against somebody who is not immune under the section. That's all right. Go ahead.
The Treasury has been the department of the government that blocks terrorist assets, and they have provided no assistance, not just in this
Nobody
case,
asked.
In any case.
Now, my question
we have
is,
asked
did anybody
them,
ask them, and that's what the statute says.
Not in
the,
right.
At the request of.
Right. Not in this case. The Rubens have in other cases, Your Honor, with respect to another judgment they have for the same act. And OFAC, which is the Department of the Treasury, takes a position contrary to the terrorism victims and contrary to aiding them in any way in the satisfaction, obtaining satisfaction of their judgment.
So your answer is you didn't ask because you didn't think you'd get it. The cooperation of the federal government.
I'm not quite sure if we thought about it, Your Honor. But we see here in this case, and one other thing, I wanted to address a few points that I don't think were brought out in the extensive briefings. In light of this court's guidelines for oral argument, there are five different classifications of antiquities that are at issue here. This case, commonly referred to as a Persepolis case, which is a collection of antiquities that were on their way back to Iran. Some items were shipped back. Some were stopped by us. They were literally packed and ready to go. These are items that were dug up in the 30s. Everyone agrees they belong to Iran. Through discovery, we learned that Iran had made claims against these antiquities year after year for 70 years, seeking their return. The second class is the Chogomish antiquities. We did not know about them when we filed our citation proceedings, which started this proceeding. We learned about them. It was disclosed by the University of Chicago. These items are also ready to go back, have to go back. The university has cooperated with the State Department with respect to their return as soon as the Iran Claims Tribunal in The Hague is concluded. The third collection is the Ernst Herzfeld collection. Ernst Herzfeld was the director of the University of Chicago's excavation. The excavation was part of one of several that universities had in the United States with Iran. They cut a deal with Iran whereby anything they dug up, they would divide in half. The excavating universities would take one half. The rest would remain with Iran. Several years after the excavation started, the State Department and the Prime Minister of Iran determined that Ernst Herzfeld was stealing antiquities. They pressured the university to fire Mr. Herzfeld. This all came out in documents that we received in discovery against the university, as corroborated in books and articles that have been written about this subject. Years later, Ernst Herzfeld came to sell back his antiquities to the Field Museum. The Field Museum, which purchased the items, could not handle the entire purchase on its own and sought the assistance of the University of Chicago. And we have the letters from the Field Museum, where they sought to share this purchase of the Ernst Herzfeld collection.
So what's your theory of Iran's ownership of this collection?
Well, these were stolen antiquities. And we're not saying that every item in the university is stolen, but Ernst Herzfeld, as an individual, had no right to dig up antiquities. He was a member of an excavation. He was fired for stealing. And now, 10 years later, he comes back to the Field Museum and wants to sell back its items.
Right.
I'm sorry.
The Field Museum knew all of this when it bought these?
Not only did the Field Museum know that, the Field Museum has internal documents that they gave us that said something like, from the director to the curator, before you buy that, you better be very careful about the provenance of these items. When the items were shipped, the provenance was never given. They do not have the provenance sufficient to show that item X was dug up on a certain day, came to Ernst Herzfeld maybe because he bought it or from some other means. And that's the huge irony here, that they now, both universities, own items from a notorious thief that the University of Chicago fired for stealing. This all came out in the documents that they gave us. We did not know this when we started these proceedings. The fourth collection is called the Dr. Grimliza collection. Dr. Grimliza was an associate of members of the University of Chicago staff. Their a PhD from the University of Chicago named Dr. Hunter Grant wrote an article which at one time appeared on the University of Chicago website saying the reason the university has these items is because Dr. Grimliza was literally walking in Iran. He went to 43 separate mounds. He literally picked up antiquities and brought them to the University of Chicago. We stumbled upon this as we got into this case. Everyone agrees that the Iranian antiquities law, which Dr. Herzfeld and others from the University of Chicago participated in drafting in the early 30s, says anything that came from the ground belongs to the government of Iran unless they came up with a concession, which they did, and most of the items at the University of Chicago are properly there because they're from a concession that they got from Iran. The Grimliza items are not.
I don't understand this. Iran says they claim no ownership interest in that collection, correct?
I don't believe that, Your Honor. I believe what they said is they haven't taken a position with respect to the ownership of those items. These items in the fourth, if you will, the
I
third
I thought in
the
their briefing place. They specifically disclaimed ownership of that collection. So while this is obviously fascinating, what you're raising here, that to me is just a dispute between you and the museum that needs to be sorted out in the district court. What does it have to do with sovereign immunity if Iran is disclaiming any interest in it?
Well, I think they have not asserted an opinion, and in fact, when the magistrate judge Ashman specifically asked Mr. Corcoran, what is your position with respect to these other classifications of antiquities, other than the Persepolis and the Chogomish, they passed, and they said, we don't take a position. And it's not, they have not specifically said that these items that were uncovered outside of the Chogomish and the Persepolis items, they do not assert an ownership interest. We think they didn't know about them because they were not cataloged and they were not made public in some respect.
But you know, here's the thing. If you're successful in proving this theory, then there's presumptive immunity.
Well.
So where does this get you?
Well, these items would be no different than the Persepolis items that were properly
also
here.
Also enjoy presumptive immunity under 1609.
Well, if they're claimed and they're items that have to go back, and if the FSIA is interpreted to create this immunity, and notwithstanding,
it can hardly be interpreted otherwise. That's what it says.
Well, there's the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, which says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, these items that are owned by these rogue states are amenable to satisfaction of a judgment of a terrorism judgment creditor.
Right. That's an exception to the presumptive immunity of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, Section 1609, and it's something that you have to prove.
Correct. And at some point, that will be an issue, when we can finally get to it, that will be an issue to
judge to determine. The district court has said that the museums don't have the authority to assert the immunity. And if the general asset discovery order is vacated as being beyond the scope of the district court's authority to issue, then we are in a sort of no man's land with respect to the immunity argument. You'd have to concede that, right?
Merely asserting the immunity doesn't mean that it's a safe harbor. It has to be litigated and has to be tested. and there are exceptions, and there is obviously the TRIA issue. So I'm sorry, maybe I don't understand your question.
Well, the question is, if the general asset discovery order is vacated as being beyond the district court's authority to issue in this attachment action that targeted the specific assets in the hands of the University of Chicago and the Field Museum. So if you lose on the general asset discovery order issue and the case is remanded for litigation on the specific collections of antiquities that are the original focus of this attachment action, the district court's order that the museums don't have any authority to assert immunity means that if Iran withdraws from the case, we're sort of in, as I said, the no man's land of nobody being in a position to assert immunity.
So if no immunity is asserted or claimed, in 1602, the very first section of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act says that they are claims of the state, so the claims of immunity that have to be asserted.
Well, it's not just the claims of the state. I mean, the text of 1609 says that the immunity subsists in the property. It's not just an immunity that can be asserted by the foreign state. It's an immunity that can be asserted by whoever's in possession of the contested property. We have to get to that issue.
The immunity can only be asserted by the owner of the immunity. It is personal to...
That's not how the statute is phrased. The statute says the property is immune.
We respectfully disagree because we think that the claim, as 1602 says, it's the claim that's owned by Iran, the claim of Iran. 1606 says that judgments are enforced against foreign states as any other private individual. There is a immunity that is out there if it is claimed. If Iran walks away from the litigation and does not assert its immunity, then these items are free to be attached, notwithstanding even the Section 201 of TRIA, which allows for attachment, notwithstanding, by its very terms, an introductory statement, any other provision of law. So it's sort of an umbrella provision that allows for even greater rights for terrorism victims, precisely because of this kind of problem. The discovery that we sought against Iran with respect to its general assets in the United States has nothing to do with the discovery vis-a-vis the antiquities, per se. We realized 2 weeks after Iran entered the case that we might be able to finally get some discovery against them. We had that right 2 years earlier when the case was first filed, and we realized that since they are here and there's an address for the discovery, if you will, we can compel them, just as any other judgment creditor should be able to compel information so that they can ultimately, down the road, execute on their judgment.
Why shouldn't you be required to identify the asset? I mean, you've been doing that all over the country. You found this house in Texas. You found property that Harvard, I think, had. You have the property here in Chicago. And you've gone to each of these jurisdictions to attempt to execute on those. Why isn't that your burden?
Well, the 1606 says that they're liable to the same extent as a private individual. Rule 69 says that
for purposes of liability.
No, 1606 follows the liability section.
But you're conflating liability and remedy or the execution issue, which is separate.
So after we obtain a judgment, the court has jurisdiction. We get to 1606, which says they're going to be liable. 1609 says deals with the exemption. Why should the judgment creditors who have been through this litigation, which Congress told them, go out, sue terrorist states as a matter of national security, go out, obtain judgments, and now they have to search throughout the country for an asset of Iran, a scofflaw that refuses to pay any judgment, refuses to comply with any, except most recently, the discovery orders, Why should the burden be on them? Why should they be treated any worse than a normal trade creditor? Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning. I'm David Cook, and I represent interveners Deborah D. Peterson. I'd like to start here on the issue of discovery, that 1610A7 gives a judgment creditor the right to reach certain designated assets. As the issue of discovery, as we argue in our brief, we make it very clear that post-judgment discovery is another form of execution. And reading 1610A7 does not exclude that means of enforcement. And listening to Iran and reading Ron's briefs and the museum and the United States is they would argue that the word execution means the use of a writ, a garnishment, turnover order, but it doesn't mean that a judgment creditor would be entitled to traditional remedies as envisioned under 69A2 or otherwise under local state law. And in fact, post-judgment discovery has the same coercive effect. And we listened to the United States, we read their briefs, and they all indicate that such discovery, or in fact any execution, would be an affront, which was the key word here. Clearly, execution of an asset of a foreign country, even in the context of 1610A7, would clearly be an affront. They would not be happy. How's that? That's true. But just the fact that you have a foreign country who would be disgruntled at its assets being attached, Congress already, as we say, been there, done that. They said we can reach such an asset. So the answer to the last inquiry of the court is saying, isn't really the obligation of the creditor to find the asset and then seek to enforce it, but of course getting a court order seeking to authorize the enforcement against that asset, which is what, as we call it collectively, the Congo cases, you know, the whole line out of the Fifth Circuit saying, no, you got to identify this asset, you got to prove that asset is non-immune, and then you can go chase it. That's, again, summarizing that entire body of law. No, that's not what 1610A7 says, and that's certainly not what 1610C says. There's no requirement in FSIA to pre-litigate the attachment of a specific asset. And what the Congo, as we call the Congo cases, Walker, whatever it would be, have said is, as His Honor has pointed out, no, you got to basically identify it first. That's not what 1610A7 says.
Counsel, the requirement flows from the general immunity that's conferred on the property of all foreign states under 1609. 1610 operates as an exception. And that's the rationale for the Fifth Circuit's jurisprudence and the jurisprudence in the other circuits that puts the burden on the judgment creditor to bring itself within the scope of an exception before having a right to discovery.
I respectfully disagree. The word was before. Before. And there's no before. 1610C is the only before, and 1610C is what we call the gatekeeper section, which says in a default judgment, one has to give notice in such and such process, not relevant, that in fact there's a judgment and such creditor is going to seek to enforce it. 1610C on its face doesn't say, and by the way, we have to tell you, foreign state or a third party, that these are the assets which we're going to seek to enforce against. In fact, it would be circular because in many times a judgment creditor might not know. Justice Bauer indicated, well, what remedies do we have as to the United States? And the answer is there's clearly the power of subpoena as to the United States. That's presuming that the United States, and particularly OFAC, would be the repository of this information. So that would presume that.
But 1604 and 1609 are worded almost identically.
That's correct.
And you agree under 1604 the burden is on the plaintiff to go forward initially in their pleadings Why wouldn't we require the same thing under 1609?
A 1604 is an immunity from suit. 1605, which follows, has all the exceptions for a judgment. For a judgment against a terrorist state, it's 1605 little a little 7 or 1605 capital A, as the case may be. In 1609, it declares that essentially all assets are immune. Following that is 1610.
Right. 1604 deals with immunity from suit.
That's
1609
correct.
Deals with immunity from attachment.
Correct.
So why should they not operate identically as far as the burdens of proof go?
That's an enforcement issue. Because in 1604, we say there's an immunity from suit. Somebody goes out and files this lawsuit. They need to jurisdictionally allege, gee whiz, I come within 1605. It's a multitude of exceptions. In an enforcement setting, we're dealing with a judgment's been rendered against the foreign state. There is no there's no suit. Suit's done. Well,
1609 is a new action.
Yeah, no,
and so why isn't it... still incumbent on the plaintiff to follow the same burden. That's what I'm not following.
Your Honor found that magic word, a new action. To respect Your Honor, it's not a new action. It's an enforcement. Judgment going forward, a judgment creditor's remedy is classically under 69A1, as the rules say, an execution. There are no more lawsuits. There are no pleadings. There are no summons. There's an execution. Take the writ of execution. Take $55. Type out a U.S. Marshal 285. Hand to the marshal and say, that's what I want. There is no execution. There's no trial. There's in an execution setting, there's no judge.
Then why do you get discovery?
We get discovery, which stands independent of execution. 69A2 says I get discovery. And in fact, even if Your Honor said no, the appearance order of June 2006 was in error, okay, which our argument is it's moot at this point, we'd say, well, okay, but discovery stands on its own. Now, if Iran decides to say that's terrific, the museums can sit there and argue to their heart's content, then we'd say that discovery order still stands because it's independent of any other right. I mean, a judgment creditor can go out and levy from here to kingdom come, and when the levy hits, it's at that point the garnishee, presumably Iran's not sitting here, sitting at third turn, but Iran's assets are in the hands of a third party, that third party would respond to the garnishment either by a memorandum of garnishee, you know, saying I have something or don't, or they would respond by motion to quash.
Counsel, the problem with your argument is that it makes immunity the exception rather than the rule. And the statutory scheme makes immunity the rule, and then there are certain limited exceptions. You're arguing this as though it were a standard collections action in state court. It's not.
Actually, under 1606, once you have a judgment...
We're under 1609, which says, in a very explicit, declaratory, plain language way, all property is immune.
And that's correct. But 1610A7 says, property used for commercial purpose in the United States is not immune and accordingly subject to enforcement. Congress has spoken.
Right, and that's an exception. So the burden is on the judgment creditor to bring itself within the confines of an exception with respect to particular pieces of property that are sought to be attached rather than the other way around.
There is no doubt under 1610A7 that in a United States court or a state court that limit of enforcement we have a Seventh Circuit case, AFCAP, property in the United States used for commercial purpose. Absolutely. But we're not reaching in this discussion the mechanism of reaching that. And the mechanism of reaching that is by use of a writ of execution. Whether the property is immune or not immune, which it could be, is a matter of process. And there's nothing in FSIA which creates essentially the interposition of a judicial proceeding between the fact of enforcement and the fact of reaching it. In reading all these cases, theoretically, somebody would have to come into court and say, I plan to attach X. The court would say, okay, you plan to attach X. It might be immune. And we'd say yes. And then the court would say, well, you know, I need to hear from a bunch of other parties. You're going to bring in Iran? And at that point, we might even have a case or controversy issue because I haven't reached that asset yet. So it does become circular to demand third parties come in to litigate a matter which hasn't come about. That's essentially where we are in that, saying, no, you need a court order first. What do you mean I need a court order first? That's not what 1610C says, and that's not what 16A7 says. It doesn't precondition enforcement to a determination. That's our position on that. As to our position on why we're here, the museums themselves should have we find their position to be irrational. The position of the museums has been saying, we wish to assert the immunity of Iran. Well, maybe they can, maybe they can't. But in this particular appellate setting, and for the last 2 years, they should have been gladdened that Iran appeared. Because once Iran has appeared, it would have alleviated the financial burden of the museums in defending this position. And in fact, on this appeal, they should have taken the position of Rubin and Peterson here and stating the following. Gee, Your Honor, you ought to make sure Iran stays here so they can assert their claim of sovereign immunity, and we're excused from that financial burden. But we haven't seen that. For what reasons, we can't tell. Our view on this is that the right of discovery stands independent, the right of enforcement stands independent, that we are not bound by the precondition of an order. There's nothing within the scope of enforcement which require that. That it's true that this is that there are some assets which are immune, but Congress said there are some assets which are not immune. And to that degree, this enforcement would proceed like all other types of enforcement. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Fingal, I think you were out of time, but I'll give you another minute or two.
You could just briefly, Your Honor. I wanted to just speak briefly to the mootness issue. I think, Judge, the district court's order is not moot in two respects. Certainly as to the Hertzfeld collection, the museums right now are barred from invoking immunity as a defense. So that obviously is a continuing effect. I think in addition, should Iran decline to continue to participate in this litigation, one presumes that under the district court's order, it would be found to have abandoned its immunity claim, and presumably that immunity claim would be decided adversely, notwithstanding the positions of the United States and the museums. Just briefly to respond to Judge Bauer's question about 1610F2A, the Department of Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control has provided information in response to reasonable requests by victims of terrorism about assets relating to Iran.
But nobody in this case asked for such relief.
Well, actually, I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. My understanding is that we have provided information about assets
without
relating
being asked?
In response to specific requests by at least some of the
does
litigants.
Does that appear anywhere in the briefs?
It does not, Your Honor, and it may not
so
be.
So it's not part of the record?
It's not, Your Honor. But we have done so in the past, and we intend to continue to respond to such requests. So I think the catch-22 point is not quite accurate. And then finally, Judge Sykes, you asked why instrumentalities should be differently treated from foreign states for purposes of discovery. And I think this relates also to the Richmark case and why it's quite different from here. I think the answer, Your Honor, is that under 1610A, execution against foreign state property is more limited by its direct terms. Only property used for a commercial activity in the United States.
Are you addressing Judge Simon?
Oh, I'm so sorry, Your Honor, Judge Simon. Only property used for a commercial activity, Your Honor, in the United States is subject to execution under 1610B. Any property of a state agency or instrumentality can be executed against. So I think necessarily the discovery scope might appropriately be broader. Thank you.
You do look an awful lot alike.
I'm so sorry.
And you're from out of town. Mr. Corcoran.
First of all, Your Honor, Iran makes no claim to these properties other than the Persepolis and the Chogomish. And I think we said that again and again and again, and I say it now. Iran makes no claim to these properties. Secondly, in response to a question by Judge Simon, we do want a ruling on general assets discovery because if there's no ruling on general assets discovery, we think that we will just get subpoenaed to provide general assets discovery again. If the court has no questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ferranti, anything further?